maintain access to the offshore islands Kimoi and Matsu. In early 1958, nuclear warheads for Matador cruise missiles had arrived in both Taiwan and Osan, South Korea. What if there were, in the course of a launch on warning or soon after it, a massive explosion on an American airbase in the region, perhaps on this very base? On first thought, that might seem improbably coincidental, stretching too far for a worst-case scenario. On second thought, less so. As far as I could tell from many conversations, no one else in the area had had the first thought, let alone the second. But no one found it implausible after a brief discussion. It was only necessary to recall why the alert F-100s, despite a command obsession with realistic drills and with meeting standards, rarely if ever rehearsed to the point of takeoff. It was precisely because of the serious danger of a crash and its possible nuclear consequences with these particular bomb loads. The other side of that reluctance, the very basis for it, was an estimate by commanders that if a number of these planes actually taxied to the runway and took off in a great rush, one or more of them might bump into another, or otherwise turn over, burn, and explode, and produce a huge explosion, spreading lethal radioactivity over a large area, and just possibly a nuclear fireball. That possibility itself wasn't remote from people's thoughts. It was why they didn't taxi. What they hadn't thought about was the next question. What would the effect of that event be on the minds of the alert pilots who had already taken off, either from that base or from another one nearby, or even from a distant base in the same region? They might, of course, guess at the true reason, that an unprecedented accident had occurred. But even if that occurred to them at all, it would be competing with another explanation, which might seem much more likely under the circumstances. After all, why were they in the air at all with their bombs aboard? Was it an unprecedentedly realistic no-warning drill, despite the risks? Or was it because a higher authority had perceived evidence of an imminent enemy attack, stronger than ever before, perhaps certain? And now this explosion, whether it was nuclear or not, might not be immediately clear, especially in the initial reporting or observation by the planes that had already taken off. The attack might appear to be taking place. At this point, a lot of communication would be taking place among the airborne planes, and they would be attempting to communicate back to the base. But if there had been a partial nuclear explosion at that base, that would be impossible. The blast itself probably would have destroyed all transmitting points at the base. But beyond that, the electronic effects of the explosion would have disrupted all high-frequency long-distance communications in a considerable area. That would mean that the last signal these planes would receive from their base, and perhaps, for quite a while, from any other bases in their vicinity, might be the sight of a mushroom cloud rising over the runway they had just left. They would then be out of communications locally. The explosion itself would black out radio transmissions. The later lack of an execute or return order or any other would have an easy explanation: enemy attack. All this in the context of the fact that they had just received a launch order that was unprecedented, or nearly so, a circumstance that in itself would make some or all of them nearly certain that an attack had been imminent. What this meant to me was that a false alarm deemed serious enough to trigger a launch command to alert tactical forces on any base in the Pacific, and probably anywhere in the world, at least where the weapons carried were such as to preclude frequent rehearsals of launch, was likely to generate the belief in the minds of some airborne pilots armed with thermonuclear weapons that, although they had not received an execute order, general nuclear war was underway and that they had no ability to receive an execute order because communications had been disrupted by the war. Thus, a launch order might be followed closely by a large high explosive or even nuclear detonation on a U.S. base, accompanied by an outage of communications, precisely because it would have led to the actual launching of numbers of planes with nuclear weapons that were known to be less than maximally safe. In fact, these probabilities, individually low but not independent, could cascade even further. If the false alarm leading to precautionary launch was widespread in the theater or even worldwide, the numbers of bases and planes involved would greatly increase the chance of an accidental explosion somewhere. But even if the initial takeoffs were at the initiative of a single base commander, a large explosion, especially with high explosive alone, which wouldn't knock out all communications, might lead to many precautionary launches elsewhere, likewise increasing the chances of a second explosion, and any of these might simultaneously disrupt communications. My knowledge of military interpretation of orders and military dedication, based on my own experience in the Marines and, by now, on a lot of time talking with high-level air staff officers, convince me that in such a situation many of the pilots would regard it as their duty to carry out their mission, the general war mission, in violation of the strict letter of their orders to await a positive authorization. Such authorizations would likely not come, they would suddenly realize, if an enemy attack had intervened soon after their launch orders. Thus, without the commander realizing it, his command to initiate a precautionary launch might be tantamount to an execute order after all. When I tried out this line of reasoning to experienced staff officers at various command posts and bases in the Pacific, nothing I heard back was reassuring. They found it unfamiliar and immediately plausible. No one came up with some operational characteristic or practice I had left out that lowered the odds of the disastrous sequence I was projecting. Finally, I felt I needed to test out these thoughts at the lowest level of command. Looking at a map at a headquarters near Tokyo, I picked out a small U.S. airbase in South Korea, Kunsan. It was the northernmost base with nuclear alert planes in Korea, that is, in the Pacific. In fact, its alert planes with nuclear weapons may have been closer to communist territory than those on any other Pacific base. Individuals in our group could get rides on military planes, and we had go-anywhere, talk-to-anyone, see-anything clearance from Admiral Felt. On short notice, I decided to take a trip to Korea and talk to the officer in charge of Kunsan. I landed in Seoul and secured a ride on a light plane over barren, unpopulated hills up to Kunsan. I found myself landing on a dusty airstrip in something like a little town in a frontier western. The officer in charge of the base was an Air Force major. He was in command of 12 F-100s, each with an underslung Mark 28 thermonuclear weapon with a yield of 1.1 megatons. Each one of those bombs had the explosive equivalent of half the tonnage the United States dropped in all of World War II, in both Europe and the Pacific. That had been 2 million tons worldwide. The major in charge of this little collection of Quonset huts and planes in the hills controlled 6.5 times World War II's worth of firepower. As best I recall, as at Kadena, these weapons were not one point safe at that time. In answer to my question, the major informed me that the pilots didn't practice taxiing or taking off in drills with weapons aboard. A portion of this squadron was on alert at all times. We were just minutes of flying time away from North Korea, but these planes were targeted on northeast Russia, perhaps an hour longer. I asked the major how long it would be if they took off toward their rendezvous area before they would be picked up on North Korean or Russian radar, and how long before they were out of line-of-sight communications with their base. He got edgy, said these were very sensitive questions, and refused to answer unless he saw my authorization. After he did this a couple of times, I got irritated and said, "Well, we'll just have to call Japan and let you talk to someone." We went into his command hut, and he tried to get headquarters in Japan by radio. This brought out the interesting fact that he was out of communications with Japan, and had been for the past few hours. He couldn't get through to Japan via the main headquarters in Korea at Osan either. I asked him how often this happened, and he said that about once a day atmospheric troubles of different kinds put him out of touch with Japan. I didn't think it was worth pursuing our discussion until he had talked to the operations desk in Japan about my access. So I waited for almost an hour, reading magazines in his hut. Osan had an alert strip, too, where I'd had some discussions before I flew up to Kunsan. It occurred to me that if there were a nuclear explosion there for the reasons I was exploring, Kunsan could be cut off from communications with the rest of the world. Finally, he got through to Japan and got the word that he could tell me anything. He asked me to run my questions by him again. I did, and he shook his head and said calmly that he didn't know the answers. That was somewhat amusing, after his expressed concern about security that had delayed us for the last hour. I asked myself if he was kidding me now, but he seemed sincere, and I let it pass. From then on, he got quite communicative. He hadn't run into any researchers before at Kunsan, and seemed to enjoy speculating about the issues I was raising. Because this base was so close to communist radar, I'd been told at Osan, the base commander at Kunsan didn't have the normal authority to launch his planes at his own initiative on positive control, even as a precaution against attack. He wasn't to launch them at all under any circumstances except on direct order from higher headquarters via Tokyo, possibly relayed through Osan. I wanted to hear him confirm that, then go on to test him on some hypothetical circumstances. It didn't end up happening that way. I asked if there were any circumstances in which he would send his planes on alert into the air. For example, if he thought they were about to be attacked. The major said, "Well, you know when I'm supposed to do it, don't you?" He seemed to be testing me, what I knew. I said, "Yes, only when you get an order from Japan or Osan." He said, "That's right." Without any break, he went on to say, "But let me tell you, I'm the commander of this base, and every commander has an inherent right to protect his forces. That's a fundamental law of war. It's the oldest principle of war that as a military commander I have the right and authority to protect my forces, and if I believed that they were endangered by anything, I would send them off." I couldn't figure out why he was telling me this, why he seemed to want to put it on the record. We had just established that I was there investigating nuclear command and control for the Commander-in-Chief of Pacific Command, Admiral Felt. And he was telling me in the most matter-of-fact way that he felt empowered by fundamental principles of war to violate the specific and explicit directives sent down by SyncPAC. It was hardly a surprise to me that a field commander might come to feel like that under some circumstances. That was the intuition that had brought me to Korea. But I didn't expect that he had already thought it through, or that he was so ready to tell me right out that he didn't feel bound by his orders from the headquarters I came from. Those orders, after all, weren't just arbitrary. They were specific to Kunsan precisely because of the closeness to enemy territory and radar. A sudden squadron takeoff might be detected and interpreted by the communists as a warning of imminent attack. In fact, in view of what the major was about to tell me, the enemy wouldn't be foolish to think that. So there was a strong reason to keep his planes tightly under higher control, whether or not the major thought that violated principles of war. But I didn't react. I wanted to explore what conditions might lead him to launch his planes. I asked him how he would interpret a sudden outage of communication that came during an intense crisis, like the Kamoi crisis just a year before. He said yes, that might well lead him to get his planes off the ground without orders from above. Again, that wasn't a surprise in itself, or wouldn't have been on some other base, where it didn't imply any violation of their directives. This was so even in an era when an outage of communications from natural disturbances was a fairly frequent phenomenon. Atmospheric disturbances disrupting high-frequency communications occurred virtually every day all over the Pacific, about once a day in Kunsan itself, the major had told me. Even underwater cables to Japan had recently been cut accidentally by trawlers. During an actual crisis, all communications between NORAD and our ballistic missile early warning system had gone out at the same time because, as I recall, a forest fire destroyed one set of landlines on one side of the continent, and an earlier earthquake had destroyed the lines on the other. Nevertheless, commanders and staff officers had told me that they would regard a sudden disruption of communications during a crisis as a very ominous sign, requiring at the least a high level of alert and perhaps a launch of some planes. So the major wasn't answering differently from other bases. He just wasn't acknowledging that his directives, which were different from theirs, were supposed to slow him down. How about a report of a nuclear explosion somewhere else in the Western Pacific? Yes, he said, that would be more than sufficient. He wouldn't wait for an order. Now the big question. I asked him what he thought would happen if he did order the planes off. He said, well, you know what the orders are. They go to a rendezvous area and fly around, waiting for further orders. They can do that for about an hour and still have enough fuel to get to their targets or to come back. If they don't get an execute message, they're supposed to come back. Those are their orders. They would be out of communications with the base at their rendezvous area, he'd told me earlier. If they were there as a part of a theater-wide alert, there would be a coordinating plane with them at the rendezvous with stronger communications gear, sent from another base. But if he had sent them up himself, they would be circling up there by themselves, unable to send any messages out. I asked, how do you think that would work? The major said, if they didn't get any execute message? Oh, I think they'd come back. Pause. Most of them. The last three words didn't register with me right away because before they were out of his mouth, my head was exploding. I kept my face blank, but a voice inside was screaming. Think? You think they'd come back? This was their commander, I thought, the one who gave them their orders, the man in charge of their training and discipline. As I reeled internally from that response, the next words, most of them, got through to me. He added, of course, if one of them were to break out of that circle and go for his target, I think the rest would follow. He paused again, and then he added reflectively, and they might as well. If one goes, they might as well all go. I tell them not to do it, though. I managed to keep a blank face. I had a few more questions to ask. Wasn't it true that there was a chance these Mark 28 weapons underneath the planes had some risk of a partial nuclear explosion if there was an accident on the runway? He nodded. I set the scene. What if the first five pilots to take off were to look back and see a mushroom cloud over the base after the sixth plane fell over and exploded on the runway? What would they think? What would they do after they felt the blast wave? That was obviously a new question for him, and he seemed to find it interesting. His first response was indirect. Well, of course, it's not like Okinawa, where that would mean to the pilots that their families had just been destroyed. He meant, it turned out, that the likelihood that pilots would disobey their instructions and go on to target without explicit orders would turn on who had been killed in that explosion, as much as whether they thought it was an accident or an attack. On Okinawa, where some of them had dependents stationed on the base, he said. They'd go on, of course, if a blast wiped out their families. After all, they couldn't be sure it was an accident, and, he implied, they wouldn't feel they had much to live for anymore. On Kunsan, if the pilots in the air realized they had lost only the major and the base, but they weren't sure it was an enemy attack, they might look for an alternate base and come back to it if they didn't get a go-ahead order. After he made this distinction, I reminded him that the premise of the question was that pilots had been launched on alert for the first time ever, whether by Tokyo or Osan or by the major. With that in mind, and all the more if this had arisen out of a crisis, he agreed that a partial nuclear explosion on Kunsan, or for that matter a report of one on Osan or Kadena, would make his pilots certain that an attack was underway. Communications would be out, so they couldn't get an order to return. They would go on to their targets. I returned to Camp Smith feeling that one of my questions had been pretty well answered. Whether there were realistic circumstances in which even a disciplined officer, not a rogue or a madman, might disobey orders not to execute nuclear war plans without an explicit, authenticated order from superiors. But throughout my work on command and control at RAND and in the Pacific Command, PACOM, I had also been asking another question as well. What if they did receive such an order? How certain was it that it truly came from the President or other high authority? Could one subordinate individual, on his own initiative, issue such an authenticated order? In theory, meaning by explicit command directives, the answer was no. But in my first month at RAND in 1958, I had come across a SAC manual describing the procedures for authenticating the execute order for bombers. It had indicated to me another vulnerability in the failsafe system that I described in my first item of classified research. I posed the possibility in that memo that, perhaps on the basis of the circumstances described above, one pilot on alert had decided that, while it isn't certain that the war is on, the chances were good enough to justify going ahead. It would seem to make sense to him, I suggested, to try to take some of his buddies with him, if he could, by sending them an apparently authentic go-ahead signal. Whether or not these conditions seem likely, I wrote, I find it interesting that it appears he would be able to do this. According to SAC procedures, the alert pilot had in his plane or on his person an envelope that had a group of code numbers, say 4, on the outside and another group of 4 in a card inside the sealed envelope. After receiving a radio signal with a group of 8 numbers, the first 4 matching the numbers on the outside of his envelope, the pilot was to open the envelope and check the numbers on the card inside. If they match the last 4 numbers in the signal, he has received an authenticated execute code, and should proceed to target. Several RAND colleagues who were knowledgeable about SAC procedures supported my guess that the numbers in the code were the same for all planes in the SAC alert force. Only a single radio signal needed to be sent out, and their understanding was that the code was changed very seldom. What I found in the land-based tactical forces in the Pacific was that the procedure, codenamed Sparkplug, was essentially the same as in SAC. According to my notes from a directive, Sparkplug procedures are the only method by which quick-strike alert forces may initially be launched, or initially directed to expend nuclear weapons on targets. Presidential authority to use atomic weapons is implicit in an authentic Sparkplug expend message. Each alert plane or command post had a double envelope. When a Sparkplug message was received, outside of the outer envelope tells the series. If message gives the correct series, open the envelope. The face of the inner envelope gives first 2 phonetic code letters. If these correspond to first 2 letters in message, launch. If a message is received then or later containing 4 letters, first 2 of which correspond to those on the face of the inner envelope, open inner envelope. If card inside has all 4 letters, expend weapons on assigned target. Where feasible and in order to reduce probability of an inadvertent or unauthorized act, the envelope should be opened while in the presence of at least one other person who is knowledgeable of spark plug procedures. This cannot be applied to airborne bomb commanders. This 2-man requirement applied only to command post procedures, either for launch or expend, since nearly all PAC-F bombers, unlike SACs, were single-pilot planes. On receipt of message, facilities will transmit message in the clear, that is, not encrypted, immediately at designated time intervals for 1 hour, unless directed to stop. It turned out to be true for both SAC and the Pacific forces that the codes were the same for all planes and changed infrequently. In both SAC and PACAF, that meant that any pilot in the alert force, whether aloft or not, simply by opening his envelope, for PACAF 2 envelopes, could learn the entire authentication code. Since any pilot in the air receiving such a signal was directed to pass it along to other planes in his squadron by direct line-of-sight, ultra-high-frequency radio, a pilot who had been launched on warning and who wanted to take a group of alert bombers with him to Russia could, having ripped open his envelopes, radio other planes at the positive control line that he had received a very faint, long-distance, high-frequency signal with the code in question. Especially under the circumstance such as I have described above, that initiative would probably be effective. Looking back at the first memo of mine on national security matters, I find that it both influenced the questions I had investigated at various air bases throughout the Pacific Command the following year, and foresaw the alarming responses I heard. No one I spoke with had earlier considered any of these issues, but none considered them unrealistic when I raised them. For example, on the matter of the envelope authentication, when I posed the possibility that a conscientious or unbalanced pilot who felt impelled to go to Target might try to convince others to go with him in the way my memo had speculated, the typical response was, "Well, he can't do that because he doesn't know the whole authentication code." I would pause at this point, waiting to hear a second thought expressed, which never occurred. Then I would say offhandedly, "Unless he opened the envelopes." Even this hint often failed to turn a light on. I'd hear, "But that's against his orders. If he hasn't gotten the whole signal, he can't open it." That answer usually hung in the air only a moment or so. The premise was, after all, that the officer in question had come to feel, on some basis or other, like General Jack D. Ripper in Kubrick's Dr. Strangelove, a few years later, that it was time to commence World War III. He was on his way to drop a thermonuclear bomb on Russia, and he wouldn't expect to come back. Everyone I encountered came to agree by this point in the discussion that there was a real problem here, however unlikely. Moreover, I had by this time discovered that a comparable situation prevailed not only with alert pilots, but also with duty officers at the level of bases, carriers, and the entire Pacific Command. And another pervasive phenomenon I found was the non-observance of the two-man rule in command posts throughout the Pacific. To prevent unauthorized action by a single duty officer with access to execute codes in any particular command post, there was a universal and supposedly ironclad rule that at least two such officers must be on duty at all times, day and night, and they must both be involved in, and agree on, the authentication of an order to execute nuclear war plans from a higher authority, and on their decision to relay this order to subordinate commands. Since physical conditions varied at different bases, each command post had, I found, devised its own procedures for assuring that this directive was obeyed. A typical procedure would be to have half the authentication code in each of the two separate envelopes, with each of the two duty officers to be present at all times holding only one of the envelopes. Then, half the codes to be sent to lower commands for execute orders and authentications would be filed in one of two separate safes. Each of the two duty officers would hold one envelope and would possess the combination to only one of the safes. If a signal with an 8-number group, say, was received in the duty office, the officers would open their envelopes and see if the two respective cards inside, each with 4 numbers, corresponded to the whole group of numbers received. Then each would open his safe and the two of them would agree, or not, to send the combined messages inside. In other posts where the office had only one safe, each officer might have just half the combination to it. One way or another, each post purported to have arrangements so that one officer by himself could neither authenticate orders received nor send out authenticated execute commands. But in practice, not. As various duty officers explained to me, oftentimes only one man was on duty in the office. The personnel requirements for having two qualified officers sitting around in every such station at literally every moment of the night were just too stringent to be met. Duty rosters did provide for it, but not for backups when one officer had to be elsewhere, to get some food or for a medical emergency, his own or, on some bases, his wife's. Did that mean that all subordinate commands would be paralyzed, unable to receive authenticated execute orders, if the one remaining duty officer received what appeared to be an order to commence nuclear operations during that interval? That couldn't be permitted in the eyes of the officers assigned to this duty, each of whom had faced up to the practical possibility of this situation. So each of them had provided for it unofficially, in his own mind or usually by agreement with his fellow duty officers. Each, in reality, had the combinations to both safes, after all, or some arrangement for acquiring them. If there was only one safe, each officer would, in reality, know the full combination to it. One officer would hold both envelopes when the other had to be away. Where there were more elaborate safeguards, the officers had always spent some of their idle hours late at night figuring out how to circumvent them, if necessary, they had always succeeded in doing so. I found this in every post I visited. The officers would tell me this off the record, but with some pride, partly to reassure me that they had conscientiously and sometimes ingeniously managed to assure that the system would work, to go, even if they or their partner didn't happen to be on hand at the crucial moment. But that meant that the two-man rule was only a facade throughout the Pacific. The system's ability to prevent one man alone from sending off go commands to subordinate units was a false promise. And that was in addition to the fact that the two-man rule, even if both men were present, was obviously vulnerable to collusion between them, or coercion, such as a gun in the hand of one of them. Either of these especially plausible in a crisis. Some 15 years later, when I described these early command and control discoveries, and this one in particular, to journalist Bob Woodward, he informed me that he himself had been a nuclear control officer on a command ship during his active duty in the Navy, and could confirm my account. He recalled vividly the precautions he and his fellow duty officers had taken to assure that one man alone could, if necessary, send an execute message to subordinate forces. There must be thousands of other former duty officers with memories of their own arrangements for circumventing the two-man rule, which to this day is trumpeted reassuringly in all official descriptions of the nuclear control system. Later procedures for controlling the launch of silo-based land missiles became much more elaborate, physical, and supposedly reliable. But even these had their vulnerabilities. John H. Rubel, former Deputy Director of Defense Research and Engineering, writes that the operators of the Minuteman missiles had circumvented the design feature requiring that two different launch control centers, with two duty officers in each, agree within a limited short time to launch. In case one of them had already been destroyed, the system allowed a launch order from just one center to be executed if there had been no signal from the other within a certain pre-designated time interval, X. In practice, Rubel found X was often, perhaps always, set at zero, making it possible for one center alone to launch at any time. Partly at Rubel's urging, Secretary of Defense McNamara later compelled the Minuteman developers, against great resistance, to install the equivalent of an electronic lock on the Minuteman, such that it couldn't be fired without the receipt of a coded message from higher headquarters. Decades later, long after McNamara's retirement, Bruce Blair, a former Minuteman launch control officer, informed the former secretary that the Air Force had ensured that the codes in the launch control centers were all set continuously at 000000. According to Blair, McNamara responded, "I am shocked, absolutely shocked and outraged. Who the hell authorized that?" What he had just learned from me, Blair continues, was that the locks had been installed, but everyone knew the combination. The Strategic Air Command, SAC, in Omaha quietly decided to set the locks to all zeros in order to circumvent this safeguard. During the early to mid-1970s, during my stint as a Minuteman launch officer, they still had not been changed. Our launch checklist, in fact, instructed us, the firing crew, to double-check the locking panel in our underground launch bunker to ensure that no digits other than zero had been inadvertently dialed into the panel. SAC remained far less concerned about unauthorized launches than about the potential of these safeguards to interfere with the implementation of wartime launch orders. And so the secret unlock code during the height of the nuclear crises of the Cold War remained constant at 000000000. The reality, as I discovered over and over in the Pacific, was that in the minds of commanders and operators at every level up to SyncPAC Admiral Harry Felt himself, the first task assigned to our study group, assuring that every unit under his command would receive as promptly and reliably as possible a go order for general nuclear war operations when Felt issued it, was regarded as incomparably more important than the seemingly parallel aim I had chosen to focus on, assuring that no forces would attack enemy targets when Felt or another higher authority had not issued such an order, and did not desire it to be executed. As we'll see in what follows, These same priorities applied in all commands and at the highest national military and civilian levels during the 50s, and to a considerable degree later. Throughout the Cold War, such priorities reflected a command environment in which it was regarded as overwhelmingly more important to assure a go response when required than to prevent a false alarm or an unauthorized action, and there was tremendous emphasis on a fast, immediate response to warnings of a nuclear attack and to a high-level go command for two reasons. One, to destroy enemy weapons before they were launched, and two, to get American weapons launched before they or command posts and communications were destroyed. Effective safety catches, whether in the form of rules or physical safeguards, meant potential delays in response, and delays were an anathema, dangerous to the mission, of disarming the enemy, and to the survival of the weapons, the command system, and the nation. For one thing, the military commanders were far more conscious than they tended to acknowledge to civilian superiors or staffers of the extreme vulnerability of command centers and communication links. In the face of an enemy believed to be Hitlerian in savagery and armed with a nuclear force believed, incorrectly, to be superior to our own, all these concerns and considerations of safety and high-level control gave way. And there was a further reason. So I was given to understand by some officers, for the Joint Chiefs of Staff to tolerate the shortcomings of the control system, to put up fierce and prolonged resistance to measures that would tighten control of nuclear weapons up and down the line. That was their distrust, above all in a crisis, of the judgment of civilian commanders and their staff and advisers, especially their willingness to launch nuclear attacks when military commanders believe them to be urgently necessary. That distrust had emerged under Harry Truman during the Korean War, despite Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and intensified under Eisenhower, especially during the Taiwan Straits crisis of 1958. It was to become even more intense under JFK and McNamara. This was reflected in what seemed to me a peculiar and startling omission. In the envelope authentication procedures of the Pacific Air Forces, which I came across early on in my research in 1959. It proved to be true as well of the strategic forces in SAC. There was only one card in the envelope, and only one envelope, with which to authenticate the last four digits in the 8-character signal. It was, in effect, a go code to execute the general war plan. There was no stop or return code in the envelope or otherwise in the possession of the plane crew. Once an authenticated execute order had been received, there was, by design, it turned out, no way to authenticate an order to reverse course from the president or anyone else, and no such unauthenticated order was to be obeyed. There was no officially authorized way for the president or the JCS or anyone else to stop planes that had received an execute order, whether they had just taken off or had passed beyond their positive control line, from proceeding to the target and dropping their bombs. From that point on, the planes, whether tactical or strategic, could no more be called back by the president or any subordinate from their attack project than a ballistic missile. This despite the fact that for many SAC planes launching from the United States, the remaining time before they reached their assigned targets after receiving an execute order might be 12 hours or more. Time enough for world history and the framework of civilization to have altered decisively since the initial order, whether by nuclear explosions, coups in the Sino-Soviet bloc, or convincing offers of Soviet surrender, not to mention the discovery of a terrible error. But that meant there would also be time enough after issuance of an execute order, as several high-level staff officers told me their superiors worried about, for a presidential change of mind. Fear of that contingency was not the first explanation to be proposed by a control officer for the absence of a stop or return order from the authentication envelopes. A common one offered was that if there were two cards in the envelope, one with numbers corresponding to stop and the other to go, in the pressure of the crisis the crew member designated to open the envelope might look at the wrong card by mistake. That was pretty feeble as an explanation. If there had been no code received corresponding to a go card, a stop code would be unnecessary and meaningless. The stronger reason given to me in 1960 was that the Soviets might discover the stop code and misdirect the whole force back. This is precisely the explanation given to the president in Dr. Strangelove for his lack of ability to send a stop order to the planes that have been launched by the mad base commander, General Jack D. Ripper. I was dumbstruck by the realism of this point, among others, when I first saw the movie in 1964. Harry Rowan and I had gone into D.C. from the Pentagon during the workday to see it for professional reasons. We came out into the afternoon sunlight, dazed by the light and the film, both agreeing that what we had just seen was essentially a documentary. We didn't yet know, nor did SAC, that existing strategic operational plans, whether for first strike or retaliation, constituted a literal doomsday machine, as in the film. How, I wondered, had the filmmakers picked up such an esoteric, highly secret, and totally incredible detail as the lack of a stop code, and the alleged reason for it? Or, for that matter, the real lack of any physical restraint on the ability of a squadron commander, or even a bomber pilot, to execute an attack without presidential authorization? It turned out that Peter George, one of the screenwriters and the author of Red Alert, the novel on which the film was based, was a former Royal Air Force, RAF, Bomber Command flight officer. That suggests that Bomber Command's control system had the same peculiar characteristics as SAC's, and probably for the same underlying reasons. The real concern, I was told privately by more than one credible staff officer, among others by Lieutenant Colonel, later Major General Bob Lukeman in the Air Force Office for War Plans, was that a civilian president or, if the president were unavailable or Washington was destroyed, some civilian deputy, on whatever basis, might have second thoughts about the attack underway after an execute order had been sent, and try either to modify it midway or to cancel it. At best, he would be passing up the opportunity for a coordinated surprise attack, and at worst, leaving our forces totally disorganized and vulnerable, along with the country, to an enemy attack either already underway or launched as soon as the enemy had detected and figured out what had just happened on our side. That's the exact argument of General Buck Turgidson, played by George C. Scott in Dr. Strangelove, against the president's attempting to recall all the planes that General Ripper had launched toward Russia. It represented fairly the view to be expected in such a situation from any number of Air Force officers, high or low. As the major in Kunsan had put it to me, if one goes, they might as well all go. Whether or not this distrust of high-level civilian readiness to initiate nuclear war, which I encountered over and over in my experience in the Pentagon, was a key motive for the absence of a card with a stop code in the envelopes of the alert forces, it was a fact that the systems designed and operated by the military assured the practical inability of the president or any civilian to reliably stop any bombers from carrying out attacks once they had received authenticated execute orders from whomever. Nor could the president then or now, by exclusive possession of the codes necessary to launch or detonate any nuclear weapons, no such exclusive codes have ever been held by any president, physically or otherwise reliably prevent the Joint Chiefs of Staff or any theater military commander, or as I've described, command post duty officer, from issuing such authenticated orders. That is, of course, contrary to the impression given to the public by every president up to the present. The impression is false, as I was to discover. Chapter 3. Delegation. How many fingers on the button? In 1959, the nuclear control officer on the staff of SINGPAC, Admiral Harry D. Felt, told me that President Eisenhower had given Felt a secret letter, signed by himself, delegating to Felt the authority to execute his nuclear plans on his own initiative, if he felt it necessary at a time when communications were out between Washington and his headquarters in Hawaii. That meant Admiral Felt had this authority for part of every day. That was how often, on average, communications were out between Washington and Hawaii, because of atmospheric disturbances to high-frequency radio transmissions. I didn't ask him if he had actually seen the letter, but he seemed certain that it existed. What he was telling me, in great secrecy, contradicted the most frequently reiterated and emphatic dogma about the nuclear control system, that there was no pre-delegation of authority, that only the president could legitimately make the decision whether or not to go to nuclear war, and that he must make that determination personally at the moment of decision. That is what the American public has been told throughout the nuclear era. For decades, that assurance of exclusive presidential control of the decision to go to nuclear war and how it is to be conducted has been symbolized, and more than symbolized, apparently embodied, by the iconic football, the briefcase carried by a presidential military aide that is to accompany the president at all times, containing codes and electronic equipment by which the president, on receiving warning of a nuclear attack, can convey to the military his choice of a response option to be executed. In a truly symbolic gesture that television cameras often capture during the inauguration of a new president, the aide carrying the football visibly shifts his gaze from the departing president to the new one at the moment of his swearing in. That shift signifies not only that the new president has acquired the full authority of his office, but also that the existence of a civilian commander-in-chief of the nuclear forces of the United States, with supposedly exclusive control of these almost godlike powers of destruction, must not be and has not been interrupted for a single moment. Now I was hearing that this impression and all the official statements that led to it were false. It was not only the president who could make the decision and issue the orders, and not even, as most people probably assumed if they thought about it, the Secretary of Defense or the Joint Chiefs of Staff in the Pentagon, but commanders in the field thousands of miles from Washington who thought their forces might be about to be destroyed. Similar letters, the control officer told me, had gone out to all the unified commanders with nuclear forces, and to the commander of the Strategic Air Command in Omaha. I had come to the Pacific in the Command and Control Study Group believing what virtually all Americans believed, in or out of the government, that the president alone was authorized to decide when to launch nuclear attacks. That was why my investigations of how U.S.-initiated nuclear war might arise, as described in the preceding chapter, focused entirely on the possibility of unauthorized actions. Now I was hearing from a very credible source that I, along with everyone else, had been mistaken. The current president had, after all, delegated his authority to theater commanders, as well as the Commander-in-Chief of Strategic Arms Command, SINCSAC. In some circumstances, commanders of four-star rank could issue in their own name an authorized directive to undertake nuclear attack, without the immediate prior involvement of the president. Surprising as this was to hear, the practical logic of making such a delegation was clear enough. Without it, the Soviets could paralyze any retaliation to a nuclear attack on the United States simply by destroying Washington before the president had given an execute order, or perhaps before there was any warning at all. That could not be allowed to happen. A single nuclear warhead on the Capitol could kill not only the president but all of his legally designated successors in the Cabinet and Congress, and the JCS, along with the Secretary of Defense, the only civilian aside from the president in the military chain of command, all of them who were in town at that moment. If nuclear deterrence were to have any substantial backing at all, if it were to be more than an empty bluff, it could not be the case that one such explosion would definitively block any authorized coordinated nuclear response to that or any subsequent nuclear attack. That would be virtually an invitation to the Soviets in a crisis, when they had any reason to fear U.S. escalation to nuclear war, to forestall reliably either a U.S. first strike or even U.S. retaliation to a Soviet preemptive attack by delivering a single warhead on Washington, decapitating American political and military leadership. In fact, if the Soviets were confident that a small initial decapitating attack would thoroughly paralyze our strategic and tactical nuclear forces, a premeditated surprise attack would look not only feasible, but also safe for them. Even the best American warning system couldn't reliably, if at all, alert authorities to the approach of just a single vehicle, in particular a low-flying cruise missile or a short time-of-flight medium-range ballistic from a submarine or a ship, or even a suitcase bomb, perhaps smuggled into the capital long in advance. It seemed obvious once I thought about it. The public's impression of exclusively presidential or even high-level military control, which I'd shared up until that moment, could not be valid. That applied all the more to the notion that only the president himself could push the button. Could a single assassin's bullet or a temporary separation of the football from the president, as has happened several times, including, later, following the shooting of President Reagan, open a window of total inability to respond to a nuclear attack? Not really. The theatrical device represented by the president's moment-by-moment day-and-night access to the football, with its supposedly unique authorization codes, has always been exactly that. Theater. Essentially a hoax. Whatever the public declarations to the contrary, there has to be delegation of authority and capability to launch retaliatory strikes, not only to officials outside the Oval Office, but outside Washington, too, or there would be no real basis for nuclear deterrence. At that time, no system of permissive action links, PALs, existed, in which a coded signal was necessary to permit the physical detonation of any nuclear weapon, or the launching of a nuclear-armed missile. This would physically prevent launch or detonation without a coded combination from a higher authority. If such a system ever came into existence, as I, among others, hoped fervently to help bring about, the combination couldn't be held exclusively by the president or by any individual or group of officials in Washington, D.C., or the Pentagon in Arlington, Virginia. If it were, one large bomb or device exploding on that joint target would lock up and render impotent the entire retaliatory capability of the United States. The most obviously necessary delegation would be to the headquarters of the Strategic Air Command at Offutt Air Force Base in Omaha, Nebraska. But that was just as vulnerable to one large bomb as the Capitol, despite underground shelters in both. SAC had at that time, and throughout the Cold War, an airborne command post with a brigadier general aboard in flight at all times. That one-star Air Force officer would have to have, and General Curtis LeMay later confirmed to me he did have, the delegated authority to direct the execution of the SAC war plan. And what I was now being told was that delegation had extended as well to the tactical forces under theater command. After all, without delegation to SINCPAC, carriers and bases all over the Pacific might be precluded from launching retaliatory strikes, just by atmospheric conditions that prevented an execute message from getting through from the Pentagon to Hawaii, even if Washington had not been hit. But the same logic applied to the problem of relaying an execute order from SINCPAC headquarters in Oahu to SINCPAC's nuclear forces. Most of these were in WestPAC, the Western Pacific, with the 7th Fleet carriers, or on bases in Korea, Japan, Okinawa, Taiwan, or Guam. They were as far from Oahu as Hawaii was from the continental United States, and communications from Oahu were just as subject to storms over the Pacific and other disturbances as radio signals from Washington were. On average, our study group learned, commanders in Hawaii were cut off from communications from or to Washington for some part of each day. Exactly the same was true for communications between commanders in Hawaii and WestPAC. Therefore, the SINCPAC nuclear control officer told me, Admiral Felt had made a comparable delegation of authority to his next lower level of command, including the commander of the 7th Fleet. Again, this was plausible, logical. And yet, like his first statement, it was startling to me. Was it really true that our practical, secret command arrangements were so sharply at odds with the policy declarations of the White House and Secretary of Defense? The control officer clearly believed what he was telling me in great confidence, as a member of a high-level consulting team reporting directly to Admiral Felt. But could he be right? I had the chance to check this out later on our visit to the cruiser St. Paul, the command ship of the 7th Fleet. As recorded in my notes of the January 26, 1960 meeting with Vice Admiral Frederick N. Kivett, commander of the 7th Fleet, and Vice Admiral Clarence E. Ekstrom, commander of Naval Air Forces in the Pacific, both emphasized the importance of the Navy doctrine that actual combat operations must be left to the engaged units acting with relative autonomy and with minimal attempt to control them by higher command. Even in limited war, Kivett said, it wouldn't matter if communications were out between Oahu and the 7th Fleet, or even between the 7th Fleet and the carrier task groups. Operations would be decentralized. I wouldn't be interfering unless I had some intelligence they didn't have. Kivett believed that a limited war would remain centralized only so long as political maneuvering predominated, with no shooting, as in the earlier Lebanon and Taiwan crises in 1958. Ekstrom had commanded the 6th Fleet in the Mediterranean during the Lebanon-Iraq crisis. The two admirals expected and approved extreme decentralization as soon as the shooting started. Thus, although they expected communications to be disrupted frequently, especially in wartime, but even for natural causes, they were both relaxed about the implications of this. They both rejected notions that pre-planning could solve problems. One couldn't plan for everything. Surprises must be expected. But at the same time, they didn't foresee or desire centralized direction during hostilities. They preferred to rely, they both said, on the judgment of the carrier task group commanders, simply providing them with objectives. And, they stressed, the commander afloat must be given great latitude in interpreting and executing his orders. You've just got to trust your commander at sea. This applied all the more, they said, to conditions of general nuclear war. They agreed that it would be nice to know what Air Force bases had been hit at the outset of a nuclear war or what carriers had been destroyed. But under the conditions of the SINC-PAC plan for general nuclear war, it probably wouldn't matter anyway. By this point in the discussion, our team seemed to have established some rapport with the admirals. I hadn't indicated to them the unease that I was beginning to feel about their seeming indifference to the unreliability of communications in nuclear war, or in a non-nuclear war that could suddenly turn nuclear. So I ventured to raise the issue I'd been told about in great secrecy. I asked Admiral Kivett if he had heard of a letter from President Eisenhower to Admiral Felt, delegating authority over nuclear operations if communications were out. He said yes, he knew that Admiral Felt held such a letter. I asked him how common it was for his own flagship to be out of communications with Admiral Felt in Hawaii. He said virtually every day, part of the day. I asked him, what if your communications with Oahu were out and you thought, for other reasons, that nuclear war might have commenced, or might be about to? What would you do? To all our earlier questions, one or the other of the two admirals had responded immediately and at length. At this one, Admiral Kivett paused meaningfully, then said to me, I stand mute. It was the only question that he didn't answer explicitly, and he drew himself up in his chair rather formally as he said it. But he was smiling, indicating, it seemed to me, that he assumed I knew the answer to my question, but that this was all he was supposed to say, and that he knew that it was, in context, an answer. Evidently he regarded, or he wanted us to know that he was supposed to regard, Admiral Felt's delegation of nuclear authority to him as a more sensitive matter than Eisenhower's delegation to Felt, about which I had already revealed I knew. After a further pause, he added, anyway, I just can't believe that we could be cut off from all communications. We could get through to someone, and he would know what was happening. Admiral Ekstrom added to this, it would depend on the whole picture, what had been happening up to that moment. How ready are we? Are we fueled up? Etc. An hour later, I raised the question with Admiral Kivett's nuclear control officer. This officer readily told me that yes, Admiral Felt had delegated to Admiral Kivett the same authority that, he said, President Eisenhower had delegated in writing to Admiral Felt, to launch nuclear weapons at his own initiative during a crisis in case of communications outage. If they were right about the letter from the President, this contravened and superseded the guidance I'd read in top-secret war planning, including the Pacific Command's General Emergency Operations Plan, GEOP, for General Nuclear War, that U.S. nuclear attacks could be initiated only by a presidential decision at the time of the attacks. The general public believed that as well, and believed further that the president would never delegate this authority under any circumstances. For once, what the public had been told corresponded to the actual secret guidance written into war plans by the JCS. Yet if these officers were correct in what they were telling me, written authorization